You're listening to TechNest,
the Prop Tech Podcast.
In each episode, you'll hear from prop tech founders, investors, and industry veterans on how they're using tech to change the way we buy, sell, and invest in real estate. Discover market opportunities, interesting data, growth tactics, and trends driving the industry forward. This isn't just another podcast about making money in real estate.
This is about how we live.
And now your host, Nate Smoyer.
Before we jump into today's interview, I want to tell you about a special promo I've got going on. Now, I don't get paid for this, but I believe in this enough to where I want to tell you about it, and I just have to share it. Blueprint 2024 is coming up September 17th to 19th at the Venetian in Las Vegas. I've partnered with Blueprint to be able to offer you guys a discount to go. Go to technest.io, top level navigation, click on Blueprint right there in the navigation, and you'll get $300 off your ticket today. I'm going to be there. The sharpest prop tech leaders are going to be there, CEOs, founders, investors, and of course, those from out in the field who are buying, selling, and investing in real estate directly and need tech solutions. You're going to be able to build partnerships, lock down deals, go home with some sales, and of course, make friends for a lifetime. I hope to see you at Blueprint 2024, September 17th and 19th at the Venetian in Las Vegas. Head to technest.io, go to the top level navigation, get your Blueprint discount today.
Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nate. Super excited to be here.
All right. Now, I recently interviewed Pat Kinsell. He's of a company called Proof. You've probably heard of it. Very popular in the lending and residential space. And I was trying to convince him before and after the interview that he would probably like distance running because he's a startup entrepreneur. He knows the grind, sure. Especially in prop tech. And I know that you're a distance runner. What kind of distances do you like to run?
I've been right around the marathon sort of distance for many, many years at this point. I did just sign up for my first half Ironman coming up this summer. So trying to mix it up a little bit. The path, I know you crush, you know, the ultra level, and I definitely have aspirations to go in that direction, but sort of want to mix it up this little bit this year and try bring back my swimming roots and biking and all of that.
It's very cool. You say crush. Most people don't realize that me in an ultra looks like a man dying just for hours on end. But nonetheless, excited to have you here on the show. For those listening, I have Zach Gorman. He's co-founder and COO of a company called Real Reports. They're an AI-powered real estate data platform designed to help agents generate leads, win more listings. And this is not your first rodeo in the prop tech startup space. Can you share a little bit more about your background and how you ended up running a company called Real Reports?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely had a non-traditional path to this space in general. I actually went to school for Arabic international security, did that for a stint, and then pivoted into the music industry for about 10 years as a recording artist and touring musician. That's sort of where I got my, you know, startup roots, I suppose. And long story short, I actually ended up starting a company with my co-founder, James, in the PropTech space, tech-enabled real estate brokerage. The vision there, like many have tried, was, you know, vertically integrate all of the different service providers who touch the transaction, build technology to facilitate that, both from a consumer standpoint, but also for the providers themselves. And it was really our experience building that company and building that technology that led us to where we are today. And namely, you know, the problems that we were coming across over and over again were how fragmented and inaccessible certain data in the residential real estate space can be. And I know anybody who's built in the space understands this problem. And, you know, whether that was our agents out there trying to find data, diligencing offers, things like that, but also on our side, when we were trying to enrich our product and our listings with new data sources, it was just constantly this issue of time, money, patience. You know, you would take 6 months to negotiate a contract with a data provider, or you had to put up six figures just to get bulk data. And the reality, I think, you know, we sort of took a big step back and we're like, you know, and this is probably a sweeping generalization, but I think a lot of people look at the real estate industry so ripe for disruption, enormous asset class. And they're like, where is this disruption? When is it going to happen truly? And you know, the last wave of prop tech we saw over the last 10 or 15 years, like we're seeing the results of that technology, which I don't think was much tech. It was a lot of fintech models and financial models that are collapsing either under, you know, pressures from investors, overinflated valuations, or from the market itself. You know, those models only existed when rates are good and inventory is high, and we're just not seeing that. So anyways, these data problems were just so crystal clear to us, and we're like, there's a huge opportunity here. And so better part of 2 years ago, we really dived in and started building.
Yeah. And I mean, I think back to even my time as a real estate agent in 2017 and some of the tooling we had, I mean, it wasn't terrible. It certainly wasn't the most fantastic. But I've had this conversation with people multiple times in the last year or so, because I think prop tech really has gone through a little bit of evolution of like shedding where the market has shed what's noise, like really getting to signal, like what's driving differentiation. But I've had this debate of like, you know, tech enabled service, whatever, you know, and I'm like, well, is it really every real estate agent anymore tech enabled? I mean, they have a website, they have the IDX feed. You can complain about it all you want, but it's actually kind of cool how much it can ship out to how many websites simultaneously and relatively fast. Then Absolutely. You have your CRM capabilities that are all, you know, automated and follow-up campaigns and, you know, and it knows where you're at in your pipeline and CMA tools and calling tools. I'm like, these are really tech heavy businesses anymore. But when you're like, where's the disruption? I don't know that it's really much has been truly disrupted. I think everything's been external forces disrupting real estate, if anything else.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, we don't even necessarily need to be looking for disruption. As you said, some of that disruption may just come due to the powers that may. But tech is still there to solve problems and create efficiencies, you know, and there's just so much opportunity. And I'm, you know, I often will have sort of a sermon about, you know, my pessimism in the industry, given what we've seen over the last couple of years, but I'm actually quite optimistic. I think we're at this inflection point where, as you're saying, like, you know, there's real signal rising. You know, a lot of those business models that just couldn't hack it, they're gone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that comes with a lot of collateral damage. And I feel for those businesses and I feel for those people affected. But the reality is, this is also the moment in time where I think the real business models that are sustainable and the companies that have been sort of quietly working behind the scenes are really going to make a difference here. So it's an exciting time. It's wrought with challenges and difficulties and always will be, but there is reason to be optimistic now.
Well, let's get into the details and talk through it. Real reports. Let's get into the brass tacks as to what it is and what you're providing to agents in the industry.
Yeah. So you can think about it as a AI supercharged Carfax for homes. I have mixed feelings about that analogy because I think a lot of people have heard it before in one sense or another, but I really do think that, you know, we're knocking on the door and have solved that problem. So we're taking in at this point, 30, 35 different data sources, putting them all in one place, and powering that by AI. So I'll sort of break that down. First and foremost, the data itself, we're talking everything except MLS data. Our sort of philosophy is number one, we work with a lot of MLS providers. We're not trying to compete in that space. Anybody who knows that space knows how hard it is to get access to MLS data feeds because of, you know, a lot of the security concerns and the way that data has been sort of maliciously used by different providers in the past. And moreover, you know, by the time somebody's coming to us, think about that Carfax analogy, they've already seen MLS data. It's so widely syndicated. They've been on Redfin, they've been on Zillow, they've been on whatever brokerage's website, whatever portal, they've seen that. They're coming to us because they want to know everything else about the property. So that's everything from valuations, permits, climate risk, flood insurance details, remodel potential, rental potential, liens, loans, transaction history. It's all in there. And it is to sort of answer everything beyond that MLS data. And, you know, having the data itself is only as powerful as knowing what to do with it. And, you know, many agents, whether it's you know, just sort of their workflow or the fact that they don't have time. Like, you look at one of our reports and there's so much in there, it can almost be overwhelming. And so, you know, we've taken a really interesting approach with AI and said, like, what does it look like to put, you know, an LLM in here and allow people to query the data in the report so that instead of having to go pine through all of that yourself and do any of that work, you're just asking a question and getting an answer. And that's really powerful, both for the agent to save them time, but also for the consumer who's allowed to interface with these reports as well and find out things that they may not have been able to, you know otherwise. So high level in terms of the value proposition, because we do target agents as the end consumer, though they may share the information or these reports themselves with, you know, home buyers, sellers. For the agents, I like to think about it sort of in three different ways. This is great for, you know, generating new business, winning deals, you know, plenty of agents going to listing and buyer presentations, because that's becoming more and more of a thing nowadays, given everything going on in the industry. They're going there armed with all of this information. You know, this is something where, again, they get access to data that you're not going to be able to get on your own, that consumers certainly have not seen at that point. They're using this as sort of the core of that listing or buyer's presentation as a way to sort of say, like, this is the kind of agent I am. I'm data-driven, I'm sophisticated, and I'm bringing you information that you wouldn't otherwise have access to. Then sort of the next pillar is lead generation. I'm not sure if you've ever used the product DocSend before, but very similar idea where an agent is able to, you know, click of a button, turn on lead capture for the report itself. So when they share this report on social media, in marketing materials, even a QR code at their open house, anybody who scans that code is required to enter their contact information. And now the agent is getting sort of a real-time snapshot of who's coming to look at that report. How often are they coming back, sort of showing, you know, signal, people raising their hands, being like, I'm actually interested in this property. And the agent actually gets to see what they're asking the AI. So let's say, Nate, you come to my open house, you're walking around, you're like, all right, you know, cool, I'm looking through the real report, you're interested in private schools in the area. I get that information on my side. So when I reach back out to you, I actually have like a really tactical way to follow up with you rather than just sort of the cold outreach. Like, hey, how was the open house? You know, I get to actually start to provide value immediately for you. And then, of course, sort of the third pillar is just research and diligence. Again, this comes from our experience working in the space, and we probably had 30, 40 agents working for us at one point. And the amount of, you know, time spent and wasted looking up property information is astounding. You know, if agents going to 5, 10, 15 different sources, they're waiting at town hall, they're pulling, you know, permit records, they're going to government websites, they're scraping data from Airbnb, trying to collate all of that. There's so much that they have to do when they're diligencing a property, whether that's to list or putting together an offer. And this is turning that, you know, hours of work into seconds of work.
Now, you just described probably the top 5% agents. Are other agents, like, they getting support from back office teams that are helping do some of this work? Or my other thought is also, has the increased level of competition, again, external factors, have led to reduced number of available transactions. Has that, and ultimately increases the competition for every listing and then every buy opportunity, has that increased the appetite from agents to go that next mile, to go that extra step? And what you're talking about, like, go deeper in the data to have an edge. Have you seen that kind of like lead as a result from the overall conditions? Okay.
Absolutely. We have, you know, again, I'm sure many of our listeners are very attuned to what's going on with all the different lawsuits, everything with the NAR. And the reality is we've had many, many people from brokerages and different firms approach us and say, listen, you know, Baird & Warner, for example, we just signed with them a couple weeks ago, largest independent brokerage out of Illinois, actually the oldest brokerage in the country. Thank you. And they're an incredible partner, but they approached us and they're like, listen, you know, we see the writing on the wall here. Things could go in any direction. Obviously, you know, things are up in the air, but the reality is it's crunch time. And, you know, for them, they have a whole philosophy around, listen, we're going to re-engineer our entire buyer's agent training program. And we want new tools and resources so that, you know, when somebody thinks about, like, who am I going to actually work with on this transaction? There's a real reason why you would work with a Baird agent versus your uncle down the street who did a deal last year. customers are becoming quite savvy, and they are really
starting
to... The
family pressure is real, though.
It's super real.
It's so real.
Yeah, but it's, you know, they're, again, consumers are becoming very aware of the reality, and it is such an emotional transaction. It's such a big moment, and you want somebody on your side who has every possible advantage that you can get, especially when inventory is low and competition is so high. So, all, you know, we are part of a larger tool set, but we really are able to, like, you know, lock in and provide that distinct value.
What's the response from consumers when they're presented with more data? And I have my own thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I, and maybe I'm playing devil's advocate here, but,
sure.
But back in my days of making sandwiches at the fine establishment of Panera Bread, when you were out of bread and the, you know, customer comes up and they want the turkey sandwich on the focaccia and you're like, oh, I'm so sorry, we're out of the focaccia. If I list off all the other breads we have, it's just deer in headlights. They just do not.
Oh, yeah.
So that I I always had a prepared answer. I recommend that sandwich on the tomato basil. Unless sure. they have an issue with tomato basil, then you go to just to get the white bread. Don't yep. even try and bother anything else, right? Do consumers want more data and options, or are they looking for like specific things that are going to help them move forward, whether it's on the buy or sell side?
It is very much the latter. So at the end of the day, again, most consumers are not the ones interfacing with these reports. Mm-hmm. We make that available because philosophically, we think that this data should be accessible to anybody who wants it out there, but the product's really marketed towards the agent. The agent may choose to surface that information either by presenting them with the report and saying like, hey, let's actually go through this together. It's a great way for them to be able to have an educated conversation together and chat through the different pieces of the report. Or the agent may just use it to arm themselves with that information so that they have, you know, the answers offhand to anything that they could be asked. But this is less about, it's also not about finding a home. It's about like, hey, we've identified the property we want. Let's learn everything we can about it because we're trying to mitigate certain issues. So for example, this comes again from our own experience. My co-founder, he and his wife were trying to buy a property out in Marin County, out in the Bay Area. And they had an accepted offer on a home and they got rejected by 10 insurance companies for wildfire risk. And this was information that they did not have up front. It was not information that was shared with them. And everybody either has experienced themselves or knows somebody who's gone through one of these horror stories of like, hey, like we finally found that place. We went through all of this process and something comes up, you know, and mm-hmm. it throws things off the rails. And like, you're already so triggered and your emotions are so high going through this process on either side. And so, you know, these reports are also there to try and mitigate some of that. So it's less about trying to dump information and data on somebody for decision-making and more saying like, let's learn everything we can to make sure that we can mitigate some of these potential hiccups along the way.
Oh, you're like triggering some PTSD.
It's bad out there. And it's so unfortunate because this is supposed to be a big
moment. And I wasn't even an agent
lives.
For a very long time. So for those who are yeah. seasoned and say like, I've been there, seen it, done it. I'm like, I always believe those people.
Yeah.
Especially when deals, you know, I had a deal. It was a three or four. I think it was three fourplexes. They were all together. So we were going to sure. do we'd worked with the buyer. They were going to do three separate conventional loans on that. I was like, well, what a deal to put together. But they used the same amount of cash reserves for each loan.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, represented $1 as $3. And, you know, they couldn't close because they were on family vacation in Hawaii and they had all these things. And then the deal gets pushed back and it gets pushed back and it gets pushed back. And this is the very last deal I worked on as an agent. And we get it's day of closing. And then I get a call from the lender that they're not going to go through because they don't actually have the reserves for all three. And I was
Yikes.
I was so I mean, I was ticked. I was like, well, you got to buy one.
Right. Yeah. Seriously.
I was like, you got to buy one at this point. but this, you know, my seller was like, look, it's fine. It's, you know, let's just keep moving. But yeah, I mean, things can happen. And certainly you don't want to find about them after the fact. Like, I'm assuming here, like, are you, you finding data that has reference to like repairs or damage, or, you know, my head right now is all around storms, because that's what we're, you know, we track a lot at roofer.com. Like when hail hits certain areas, like that's a roofer's heyday. So, you know, you got to get out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is all that
kind of included? A lot of that climate information, you know, are you near a Superfund site? Are you near a brownfield? You know, what kind of incidents have happened? Big storms, you know, looking at all of the breakdowns of the different risks, like pretty much all of that's in there.
Got it. I want to back up a little bit and kind of talk more about a little bit of branding. So you guys went through a rebrand, previously known as BHR, switched to Real Reports. Can you talk more about the decision to go through the rebrand? What were some of the challenges in that? And how does this better reflect where you're going as a company?
Sure. So without getting too deep into ancient history, you know, at the outset, like this company has been and will always be about the accessibility of data in our space. And one of our initial approaches, which, you know, sort of coincided with a lot of signal in the market period of 2 years ago, was around the immutability of data and, you know, storing this data in blockchain technology. Anybody who's familiar with both spaces, real estate and blockchain, knows that there are endless examples, namely, you know, in title, but all over, of like how these two things can really coincide and make something beautiful. So we were really, you know, pushing down that track of like, how do you put all of this data, you know, in a place that it can be instantly accessible, also private, which was one of the big hurdles that we, you know, had to face pretty quickly along the road. And we were also trying to discover, like, is there a way, because there's a huge gap in real estate or real estate data on the consumer side, like what's actually in the home? What are the pieces of the home? How often are things getting updated? So we were trying to figure out, is there a flywheel we can create by sort of creating the immutable record for somebody's property? And the more data they add about the property, the more access they get to a wider data set about the home. In reality, you know, we were also trying to fundraise around then, and things like FTX occurred, market collapses, and more than anything, we just weren't finding a path to revenue. Consumers are fickle. It's hard to make them do anything. Homeownership platforms, we've seen a ton of them, and there are some great examples out there, but it's really hard to get consumers to do anything. And it's wild, because I think about myself and I'm like, I would love to have these platforms to upload all my information, manage my household, but there's a balance there, because then you start to think about all, you start to see everything you need to do, and it creates the anxiety. You know, it's a difficult nut to crack. So needless to say, we were like, we got to pivot. You know, this is not the area for us. And so we started working on the Real Reports product, really switched our, you know, target audience more to the real estate professionals, the people interfacing with this data who need it on a day-to-day basis. Because also for the homeowners themselves, you know, oftentimes they're thinking about this stuff at the moment of transaction, but then things sort of, you know, drift away after that. So we knew, you know, originally our company's name was Blockchain Home Registry. And that is, you know, it's great when the market around blockchain technology is great. It is not great to have in your name when things are going haywire and everybody's looking at this being like, are you just a casino to steal my money? Like, what is this? Like, what's going on here? And we're like, okay, so let's get away from that really quickly. And same for investors. They're just like, I don't even want to hear the pitch. Like, you got that, you know, they see that in the email address and they're like, I'm not touching this. We can't, you know, we have fiduciary duties at this point. We're like, we're not going to touch anything in the space. So we were like, all right, let's extrapolate from that as quickly as possible. Started going by BHR just to sort of anonymize that while we dug in and said, like, what are we going to become here? And the product name Real Reports, you know, came pretty early on. We're like, this is great. You know, it makes sense. It's easy to say, it's easy to remember. The process of the rebrand was just flick a switch, you know, like do a sprint, get it done. I think oftentimes companies and brands go through this really exhaustive process of like, let's go from bottom to top and just re-engineer everything, fonts, the way that our brand speaks, you know, graphics, image, everything. And it was like, we don't have time for that. We're a scrappy startup. Like, we got to get moving. We're trying to sell. Like, that's what we're focused on. So, I mean, in the background, I had already started doing little bits here and there, but it was more of a matter of just saying, like, you know, yesterday we were BHR, today we are Real Reports, and we just have to own that. And we'll put out some press around that. And just, you just got to lean in. Rebranding, I feel like it can be a trap. I think it's really sticky, and it's like, what are your goals right now? You know, mm-hmm. for larger companies with a ton of brand awareness, and sort of, you know, acknowledgement in the market of who they are, I think it's it needs to be a much more thoughtful process, but we're so early, and most of the ways that we're doing deals now are, you know, handshakes. We're not worried about Google SEO or anything like that. So it's like, just flip the switch and go, like, move on to bigger priorities.
This is really important, I think, for people to hear, because the amount of time and attention that goes into brand really depends on where your company is at stage-wise.
100%.
You know, for instance, like behind me on my, well, you can't see it because my video is kind of blurred for the background.
Okay. But
there's a red book, and this was sent out to all employees at realtor.com as like our brand guide. It's a tool.
Yep.
It took over a year of a dedicated team to put this together. And at that level, maybe that's justified. You know, I think there was probably still a little bit too much. You know, the infamous rebrand of Instagram. You know, if you remember, it was that brown, like Polaroid-ish looking thing. And when they rebranded, people were like, this is like Microsoft Paint. You know, it looked like the old Word fonts that would have like the gradient on them.
Yeah.
And but now it's really hard to imagine it not having gone through that transition. And it was something that spoke to like where that product was going. And they did a really good job of capturing it. I have been unable to avoid rebrands in the last three companies, and including my podcast, has gone through a rebrand. And, you know, when I joined Avail, they had just previously rebranded from being Rentolutions to Avail, which I'm so glad they did, because Rentolutions. And Ryan and Lawrence know my feelings on that name is just absolutely terrible. They know it was terrible. Right. And, but they, I mean, they did put some resources into like picking some font colors, and it was a total change. You know, at OB, we didn't have much of a rebrand, but we had a domain change. And a domain change is just as scary, because, I mean, things can break all over the place. And then at River, when I joined Roofer.com, when I actually started working with them, when they were known as SmartRoof AI.
Yep.
And you know, kind of similarly, like, consumers didn't really know what SmartRoof AI is, and how do you build a brand around that? Roofer.com sounds like that natural brand. But I mean, the switch, you know, if you're early stage, I've grown comfortable in just like, what's the 80% that has to get done? Everything else, we'll pay the debt later.
Like 100%.
You just sometimes have to move and make that switch, because, you know, in the bigger picture, that change is actually going to be more helpful in having those conversations and opening up those doors. What's been the reception from customers once you made that switch?
Everybody's like, great. This makes a ton of sense. I had no idea what BHR stood for. And again, because we were proactively trying to, you know, redact that part of our history, not because we don't stand by it, you know, and we're proud of it, but just because that's not who we were anymore. And it wasn't additive to the brand. You know, you don't want to confuse people. Like, the worst thing you can do as a brand is confuse somebody and get them too caught up in like, are you this? Are you that? It's like, we just need to focus on one simple thing. It's like, that's Real Reports. There's not the company and then the product within that. Like, those are not separate things. It's like, the company Real Reports has the product Real Reports. Like, just keep it simple.
Yeah. You have to have something that's memorable, shareable. Otherwise, it's really difficult to have any sort of true net promoters in the market. And in real estate, which especially from agent to agent, it's pretty important to have that trust. Otherwise, people don't make the jump and try out new tools. Well, the other bit of news, or it's kind of recent for you guys, is you just closed a seed round of funding. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, this has been a tough time for founders in the last like 18 months or so. What's that been like? First off, congratulations on the round of funding. Obviously, that's a good indication of, you know, others seeing what you guys are working on and the promise there. But maybe you can talk a little bit about what it's been like going through that process most recently.
Admittedly, it was very difficult. And the first advice I give anybody who's, you know, early stage and looking to go raise is be honest with yourself right off the bat and say, like, is this a business that needs to raise venture capital? And also, you know, there are plenty of, there's a question of like, does it need to raise venture capital at all? But then there's a question of like, how much venture capital does this company need to raise? Does it need to keep raising more and more and more rounds? Because there's just a lot of calculus. And I think our team has grown more and more comfortable around the fact that, you know, there are alternative paths, but it's also great to bring in those resources and get those great investors behind you that can really level things up. But, you know, we've seen the result of overinflation in that space as well. And you've got all these companies now in the public market that are, you know, down 90%. You've got all these Series A and B companies that are dead in the water because they can't meet the expectations. So my advice is always just like, be really real about that to start. And then understand that it's going to take up a lot of time. It's going to take up a lot of resources that you could just be using to build your company. And I understand again, that you got to, you know, meet yourself halfway there because sometimes you need those resources to go build, but yeah, it's difficult out there. And honestly, it was a really humanizing experience for me. I'll be the first to admit, I probably had a somewhat negative view on the venture capital space, having gone through a couple rounds before and just, you know, seeing that culture at sort of at the zenith of its craze. And this past process, you know, I probably began the fundraise for what we closed in November. I probably started that 10 months prior, if not 12. It's a long process. Like, you need to get to know, you should want and you should expect to get to know these investors and not just go out there and say, like, here I am, who wants a piece, and just take whatever comes at you, because you're going to be working with these people forever. And it's really important that you have people on your side that you want to talk to, that you can actually collaborate with. So, it's a long process. It's a hard process, but there's, you know, a lot of good that can come from it. And I'm super grateful that we have, you know, such great folks that we've been able to bring in, and they're already adding value beyond those checks, which for early stage companies, I can make an argument either way of like what you're really looking for, but sure. Ideally you want those first investors to be able to help you beyond just here's some cash.
Yeah. It was very cool for me to see that you guys are modern Portco as well. You know, yep. Same with the, and I know we don't really have like teams in prop tech, but I kind of like to think so, you know, you get some of the 100%. Same, investors, you got to think through like, hey, all right, same team here. How do we maximize some of this? So I've already been thinking through it. There might be some things here, but, yeah, very cool to see them. There's good folks over at Modern, and, you know, congrats on you. I mean, I think, you know, I've heard from other founders saying like, maybe some of the tide has been turning a little bit as far as the optimism and outlook for prop tech and investment. But again, we're also going through this phase of like the signal is coming to the top. And I think that's just going to mean less deals and a little bit more scrutiny. So if you've got legs to stand on, you've got some decent metrics, you're probably, you know, going to be okay. But otherwise it's going to be a slog.
Yeah, the bar has definitely shifted. The expectations, you know, what would have been sort of pre-seed evaluation feels more like seed, and seed feels more like A. And another piece of advice I give founders is, you know, one of the hardest positions you can put yourself in, especially if you're trying to get money fast, is raising a pre-seed after you already have something in market. Because the second you go to market, the second you start making money, you're going to get benchmarked against that, and you're getting benchmarked against growth. It's not just about the team or the idea. And, you know, again, that's going to add 6 to 12 months of time for you, because again, investors are looking to de-risk this for themselves, and they want to see how you operate, how you grow. And if there's not enough signal for them, they've got thousands and thousands of other deals that they can take. And, you know, again, you have to sort of humble yourself as a founder, because you're like, well, but I've got the whole vision, I've got the whole idea. And like, but they're trying to return their fund. That is, you know, for the, at least the institutional side, like,
sure,
those are first principles, and you have to really, you have to fit that mold. And that doesn't mean that you have to, you know, forsake your vision or give up, you know, your sort of ethics. But the reality is you both are meeting each other halfway. And I'll be the first to admit, in the past, I've probably been too proud as a founder and said like, no, like, you have to this is just me convincing you about how smart I am and not really trying to meet the investors where they are and understand and sort of empathize with the situation that they're in.
Appreciate that. Zach, we're going to jump to the bottom of the show. Segment I like to call For the Future. For the Future is when I get to ask each guest who comes on the show to give their best predictions based on the following four questions. Are you ready to play?
Let's do it.
All right. Number one, what does Real Reports look like 1 year from now?
My hope is that we have really significant market penetration. At this point, you know, we've been really diligently going through the process of working with partners across MLS and brokerage. And reality is those deals take time. You need to get to know these people. You need to get to know these organizations top to bottom. Similar to what I was saying with the investment side, you need to understand like where you fit into their needs and their roadmap and the things that are going on in their entire ecosystem. So we've been at it for about 12 months now. And so those deals are really starting to flip and we're getting those contracts signed and there's a lot of momentum. So for me, I think a year from now, you know, we've got product market fit and we're really looking to scale. But yeah, sort of in that next phase of maturity as a company.
All right. Number two, we're really gonna have to break out the crystal ball here. Describe the state of real estate data in year 2030.
That's a great question. Part of me thinks that there will still be some of the challenges that we see today, because it is just such an exhaustive space and there's so much information and access to even more information is now, you know, happening in a rapid clip. And there are new bodies and data sets being built out there with all the new services and technologies. That said, I'm also optimistic that, you know, with companies like ours and with organizations like Rezo, who are really working to, you know, create standards and practices around real estate data, we are going to get closer to a world in which data can be used as a utility and is much more seamlessly accessed. I think if we can get to that point, even just a couple shades different than we are now, you're going to just see a bloom of new ideas and business models and efficiencies created, which can hopefully help everybody across the ecosystem, help consumers. I think we're heading in the right direction. There's so much motivation. There are so many great people and smart minds like thinking about this that were not, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, I have optimism, but it's a big challenge and it's different in every state. It's different in every country. It's different in every municipality. You know, there are a lot of challenges, but there's also, you know, a spark there that I'm excited at least to be a part of.
Number three here on Four of the Future. What's one industry trend you think will continue, but you wish would go away?
It's a good question. I think my immediate answer, and there's sort of a caveat here, is that I'll call it sort of Gen 1 AI. I think that similar to how I felt about blockchain technology, there's a lot of gaslighting and pomp and circumstance around AI. And there's a lot of applications for it that I think are not substantive. I think they're just there to try and capitalize on the fervor and, you know, get people to have money change hands. So I'm excited for us to get over that hump and into a world where, because in reality, I think AI is just going to be ubiquitous in almost every type of tech company, every kind of platform. Like there's going to be something powering there. This is sort of like, it will become the new software in essence. But for me, I'm excited for this sort of, you know, the trend of let's raise the AI flag because we can, and we have access to these tools now, but not actually providing value. I'm excited for that to sort of fade into the background.
Yeah. I kind of joke about how TechNest is an AI powered podcast because I had set up a Zapier to automatically write emails to people who submitted inquiries to my Airtable form. I mean, I'm not technically lying in that, but is that really, no. I don't know. I hear you on that front. All right, last one here. What's one thing you believe will dramatically change or fade away in real estate as a result of tech advances?
My hope is that this is sort of a sweeping statement, but just that we're going to be able to move beyond predatory business models, especially sort of in the fintech space. We saw so many of the, we buy ugly houses models rehashed in this last wave. And I don't know, it's just not what it's all about to me. There are a lot of ways to make money, a lot of easy ways to make money, but there are some great companies out there doing great work with, in that fintech space, but I just hope that with more data, with more technology, there also is, a rebalancing and sort of a democratization of access to information and, just a movement away from some of the predatory business models that we've seen in the past. I don't know. It's just not my thing.
Zach, this has been great. Thank you for coming on the show, breaking things down, sharing about Real Reports, your journey, the rebrand, where data is heading, and really even what agents are looking to do and have to do to stay competitive in this very interesting time in residential real estate, for sure. Before we close out, for those who want to get in touch with you and or learn more about Real Reports, where do they go and how do they do that?
Always feel free to reach out to me directly. My email is Zach, Z-A-C-H, at realreports.ai. You can also visit our website, realreports.ai. That's it.
There it is. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the show. I will see you around on LinkedIn, as I always appreciate your engagement on content there. But hopefully we'll get a chance to meet this year at one of the upcoming events.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks so much for your time, Nate. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to TechNest, the PropTech podcast. Find all the links and resources mentioned in this episode on technest.io. You can get future episodes delivered to your ears directly by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all other major podcast apps.
Follow TechNest on social media to stay up to speed on new developments, resources, and announcements in PropTech.
Your support is greatly appreciated. There's two ways you can directly support this podcast. Share episodes you find interesting, and then leave a review of the show in the App Store.
From Nate and the TechNest team, thanks for listening.